Lectionary Lab Live is recorded in the studios of the 405 Oxford Group, Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina, a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, bubba.
Hey, bubba.
Good to hear from you today. We're getting ready to talk a few texts for preaching. These are the texts for the fifth Sunday in Lent, April the 6th, 2014. We got plenty of scripture again. This has been the year for long Johannine texts in terms of the gospel. Some great stories, but takes John a while to spin them. And then, of course, we'll be hitting our text from Romans, Psalm, and the Valley of Dry Bones from Ezekiel 37. What do you want to say to set the tone today as we're getting ready, sort of an overview and, you know, our considerations for preaching?
Well, it's interesting, something you said just before we came on there. Mm-hmm. We have two texts about resurrection, neither of which is really about resurrection.
Right.
And I'm going to invite you to unpack that a little bit.
Well, I'm like everybody else. And you read the Valley of Dry Bones and, you know, God raising up an army. And so is this a resurrection? And then we come to Lazarus. It's kind of an interesting story. I get what the story of Lazarus is about for the most part. But I kind of feel for Lazarus, you know?
Yeah.
And I have been in on discussions whether this is resurrection or resuscitation or does it matter? He was dead. He was stinking. It was 4 days. And you got to think, well, this is not the resurrection to eternal life for Lazarus. He's going to die again and go through all of this. So I want to be careful to just put my feet down and say, hey, everything we need to know about resurrection, we're going to learn today in Lazarus and in the Valley of the Dry Bones.
Yeah.
But what are we going to learn? I guess it's a good question.
Yeah.
We have preachers everywhere going, what do I say? Yeah.
One of the things about these long Johannine stories is they're all follow a pattern. They are sign stories. And you know, here's the sign, and the sign gets explained. Sometimes the sign happens and explanation follows. Sometimes the explanation fills up all the time before. Mm-hmm. And then there's a sign. And the key underneath that is the revealing of the glory of God. You know, we find the back over the man born blind. Why was this man born blind? Was it because his parents sinned? And Jesus, no, so the glory of God could be seen.
Right.
So always one of the things in John is that things happen for those who are observing more so than for the person involved.
Right.
You know, and the story itself is constructed. And I think we can say this more about John. Perhaps it's more evident in John than the other gospels. They're carefully constructed for a theological or philosophical or rhetorical point that's trying to be made. And part of the problem is we're 2,000 years removed and our methodology of making points is different.
Right.
So what was fairly obvious, I think, to a lot of the early readers, to us just is like, What is he talking about? We are like the unnamed disciples who are kind of like the Greek chorus throughout all of these things,
right,
who are always confused. Mm-hmm. You know, the woman at the well was confused and the disciples come back and confused. In this story, we start out with unnamed disciples who were just like, well, why are you doing it this way? So let's walk through this one and then we'll tag into the other stories.
Let's do walk through it. And I will admit right off the front, I'm probably reacting a little bit against the approach that takes this story and says, see, this is how we know we can trust Jesus, because he brought Lazarus back from the dead. And I always want to say, no, we trust Jesus because he's Jesus.
Yeah.
But the sign is for something. So I agree.
Well,
let's walk our way through the sign
that this is the Son of God. You know, there's things in this story that cause us, as you said, we trust him because he's Jesus. And there's a place in here I'm going, yeah, well, if that's the way you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few of them. I mean, here he
hate
is.
Hate to see your enemies, yeah.
Yeah, he's hanging out with his unnamed disciples, and here comes Mary. And she comes and sent, well, she sends a message. Oh, Lord, the one whom you love is ill. My brother, who your best bud, mm-hmm. you know, is dying. And then there's verse 4. But when Jesus heard it, said, this illness does not lead to death. Rather, it's God's glory, so that the Son of Man, God, may be glorified through it. And I'm sitting there going, if I'm Lazarus, I'm dying, and you just want to hang around, let me die so you can raise me up so you look good? This is not cool. This feels strange. So, accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sisters and Lazarus, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. This has a kind of calculating feel about it. Mm-hmm. He could have spared Lazarus this, it appears.
Well, that's what Mary says here. Yeah, so, like, excuse me, Martha says soon as the passage unfolds. Yeah.
If you'd come. And so then he waits and he says, okay, now let's go to Judea. Now you have this aside story in which you understand that Jesus going to Lazarus is the prelude to his own death. As one commentator put it, for Jesus, Lazarus to live means that Jesus must die. And the way this story unfolds, because at the very end, and you need to know this going in, at the very end, they see this sign, and certain leaders and the chief priest, as it goes on, decide, as Gamaliel says, it's better for one man to die. Mm-hmm. Part of the theme with this story is leading to the cross, and for the post-resurrection community John is talking to, this is a way of understanding the death of Jesus, is that he died so that we might live. That sacrificial nature of what's going on and the risk that he took eventually. So he goes and the disciples are saying, we can't go to Judea. They're going to stone us. And Jesus says, but we got to go. See that? Mm-hmm. He's flint, not afraid. And they're going, but this is nuts. And then this is where I just love, this is the other side of Thomas, you know?
Right.
You get down here and after this argument where he says, you know, Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to awaken him. And they say, oh, well, he's just in a coma. You know, we'll just let him wake up on his own. You know, we're not going to go get stoned. And they're still trying to fight it. And then Lazarus says, I don't get this, but we put in our chips with Jesus. Let's go with him. He dies. Let's die with him.
There you go.
You know, the statement of faith.
Thomas, the truth teller. You know, he gets that bad rap as the doubter, but he just tells it like it is. There's several. Every time we hear Thomas, he's saying something very forthright, including the very famous post-resurrection Thomas. Yeah. I'm not going to believe it unless I see him. That doesn't come out of doubt. He's just, he's pragmatic.
He's saying what he sees, you know, the 16th. So he says on verse 16, all right, I'm not getting convinced that this is a good idea. But because it's Jesus, it doesn't have to be a good idea. This is an issue of faith, I think, communicated here. And so they all go traipsing off to go see Lazarus. And then they get met by Martha. She meets him and says, if you'd have been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Well, we know this because Jesus said, I'll wait a couple of days and let him die. Then it'll be even better when I heal him. But then she says a statement of faith, and she says, your brother will rise again. Then they have this fascinating dialogue about the resurrection and in the last day. And this is a messianic statement. See, this is the first time that Jesus talks about, I am the resurrection and life. Mm-hmm. This is to the post-resurrection community, claiming not only his own resurrection, but theirs. Those who believe in me, even though they die, they will live. So this is the whole thing is building up to almost a Lazarus as an object lesson, you know, a proof that this is this person who's about to die is indeed the Messiah. So you keep walking it through and then you go on to the sisters and the other one has the same dialogue. It's almost a repeat, except when he sees her weeping, he's greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. And it's almost like, Lazarus dying doesn't bother him as much as his sister getting upset.
Yeah, seeing the loss that's going on here.
can't deal with the woman's tears almost. You'd almost, you know, seeing the loss. Although what some New Testament scholars say that using cultural analysis, they call it anthropological, is that his greatly disturbed had to do with that it made him look bad, you know, something along those lines. I don't quite get this. I take it more as it said that he just really loved these people and it really upset him. Mm-hmm. And he wept himself.
Well, you hate to see people that you love going through stuff like this, even if you know they're going to be okay on the other side. Again, as pastors, we sit with people and we hold their hands literally or figuratively. We offer what we have, which is, prayer and words of hope. And you can't explain everything away. I don't see Jesus trying to do that either. He basically is offering them what he has. But even if folks are going to be okay on the other side, you hate to see them hurting.
Right.
And I guess I choose to see that this way. I don't think Jesus is mad or upset because, Mary's breaking ranks here. I don't think he's worried about how he looks or anything like that. No. I think he loved him. That's why the text said what it did. And a good example, I guess, if you will, a good reminder to us as pastors. The work we do is hard sometimes.
Yeah.
But you wade right on in.
Well, verses 37 and 38 kind of are a turning point in this text because it's talking about the different ways people responded to Jesus at this point. Some of them said, oh, see how he loved it as Jesus began to weep. I really hate they changed 11:35 from Jesus wept. It was better the shorter it was.
Jesus wept, yeah.
But so some said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind have kept this man from dying?
Mm-hmm.
There is the core question. Who is this? He heals blind people, but what are the limits of his power, of his glory? And this is the point I think the writer of John is trying to get to, is exploring that Jesus is indeed the Son of God, is God. As it said, again, greatly disturbed, he comes to the tomb, take away the stone. Lord, there's already a stench because he's been dead 4 days. This is 4 days is really about he's really, really dead.
Right. He's past the time of the spirit returning to the body, et cetera.
Yeah.
Some of the background beliefs here.
And when I hear that line, I remember that line in from the mayor of Munchkin Town or whatever with the certificate, the little song. He's really, all those long lines about certifiably dead. He's dead. Mm-hmm. It was a real miracle because he was really dead. But his response is, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And again, this is the point that I think that John is coming through with this gospel. The story is to show the glory of God and who he is. So Lazarus come out, and out he comes, bound with strips of cloth, unbind him and let him go. And then it says, some believe, but then you move on from 45 into the next verse. I know we're stepping outside of the pericope, and others began to talk together and went to see the high priest, which I think is a vital part of the meaning of this story, is the piece that comes after 45.
They're going to tell on him.
And what is that response? So a couple of ways of approaching this, depending on the amount of time you've got. I think it's tempting, and I did this last week with these long passages, to take a tidbit, a nugget, and preach on it, and it's not a bad choice to make. I think a bit about Thomas and what does it mean to have faith in the face of things you don't understand, following Jesus in areas where you're not completely sure what's going to happen. That's a good direction to go. Interestingly, divides into three groups and their responses to Jesus in this circumstance. If you can quickly you read the gospel through and retell the story in a shorter form, that would say, well, Jesus hears that his good friend is dead, chooses not to go until after the friend has already died. goes, and he has this conversation with the sisters, and ultimately, and Lazarus and Mary and Martha are very popular folks, so there's lots of people from Jerusalem around and knowing about this, and ultimately he goes and does the resuscitation or whatever we want to call it, the resurrection, mm-hmm. raises him. And but you have three different groups, essentially, and their response to Jesus. You've got the disciples, unnamed disciples, and their dialogue. Then it moves to another scene of the sisters and their dialogue with Jesus that kind of follows the flow. Then you have throughout the Jewish community's response to Jesus. And it's the Jews here, you know, this is one of the things to be careful with, because too often in John, when he says the Jews, you got to know which Jews he's talking about, mm-hmm. you know, and they come off pretty positively here. They're a community. I can see this as a small town or country church community gathering around, consoling, bringing mm-hmm. food. They're there. They're weeping with him. It's a mourning community, you know, and some are just moved by how much Jesus cared, but others are disturbed by what goes on. And report it to the authorities, and they're the people he's in trouble with, and, you know, there's the political stuff. So you can sort of move through how people respond and how do we respond. Do we respond mm-hmm. with disciples? We don't really know what's happening, but like Thomas, we'll follow.
Yeah.
Like the sisters, a more intimate relationship in which you can both express your faith and trust and also your kind of disappointment with God, as Philip Yancey calls it, as the sisters did. And then the Jewish folks who are both admire, but some run away, you know, where are you? And that's a good preaching kind of tool, is inviting people into the story mm-hmm. and by various scenes.
Well, I think I want to jump in for just a second.
Yeah.
And the whole line of questioning we started with today has opened up something for me that I don't think I've ever quite seen from this passage, or I've certainly never used it. I think for me, the issue is, will I follow Jesus? Will we follow
yeah.
Jesus?
Yeah.
Thomas clearly says, as you said, you know, hey, fellows, you know, we made a commitment here. We're all in. Let's go. And you've got that. There's the call to Martha and to Mary. Do you believe in me?
Yep.
Will you follow me? Will you trust
yep.
me? And so it's common for us to say, well, I'm going to follow Jesus all the way through death.
I'll go with him all the way. What is that?
That's, you just said it. But here's my point. Here's what struck me. Lazarus is the only one that's ever been called to trust and follow Jesus back through death.
Yeah.
Into life, back from the other side. We were kind of kidding around before we started yeah. the show today, saying,
right.
you know, Lazarus, he's died, and what, you know, whatever's there on the other side, he's been to the light, he's seen the glory, and to be called back, surely
yeah.
at some point Lazarus had to ask Jesus, why did you bring me back, Lord? And I can almost hear Jesus wanting to say, Lazarus, do you trust me? I'm sorry I had to do that to you. But follow me, trust me. And the same words that are spoken to Mary and to Martha are spoken, I think, to Lazarus and implicitly to all of us. Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So I think that's kind of what I'm working on this time around.
There's mm-hmm. another interesting piece in that as you talk about that. Is that I'm thinking that we always in the West, and we want nice middle class professionals and other folks mm-hmm. like that, we always assume that we have some choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we choose to follow. I don't want to get into Arminian and Calvinist, but we have some choice. And this is a great image of saying, you know, Lazarus, God works through us.
Mm-hmm.
And see, he shows God's glory through the raising of Lazarus, and Lazarus didn't have nothing to do with it except to die and come out of the grave. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And how many times, John, in my 30 years or so, in our 30 years or so, have we found out that God worked through us to show God's glory, and we didn't have much to do with it?
We had very little to do with it most of the time. That's absolutely true. Showing up. Which is kind of what Lazarus does here in one way of looking at it. He's here when Jesus wants to call him out. He says, Lazarus, I need you. Come out. And that's what he does. Well, I don't know if we've helped anybody. We've talked about a lot of issues in this passage for today. Again, it's long. There's any number of places to jump in, whether you work your way through the story, whether you think about a theme, whether you take just a passage or a part of the statement, whatever it may be.
This is one of the few times that I wish I could be a contemporary worship pastor just to have the screen and show a clip of the mayor of Munchkin and all the Munchkins singing about being absolutely, positively, certifiably,
legally, completely dead. Yeah, all that. Let's move our way back to another pile of dead folks, the Valley of Dry Bones.
That's right.
In Ezekiel 37.
Well, you know, there are a couple of things that I want to observe. One is the very dry line there. It talks about there being dead for a very long time. Mm-hmm. This is one that I think that it's important to take a more corporate look at than individual or personal. I think Ezekiel's talking about the people of Israel and the nation, and they look dead as a people. And can God bring them back? This is, as you say, this is not exactly about resurrection. It's more about reviving that community. A couple other things. This text beautifully plays off the word ruah, and its three contexts all are shown in this short text about wind and breath and spirit. And if I were preaching on this, I would probably, just because I like playing with language, play with those three things and the issues of the wind blowing where it will and bringing life to the planet and disseminating things. And then the breath that we breathe, every breath we take is without breath, we don't live. And the spirit and how God it's invisible, but it's that which empowers and, you know, all kinds of imagery, as you know, and that's a nice, usage there in terms of, and I think, you know, I don't think you want to stay an awful long time in the times of Ezekiel. I think this is one of those that congregations and just as a sense of who we are as a Christian people in the 21st century talking about, they're all around us. There are people talking about the decline of the church and are we a valley of dry bones and as a congregation or as a faith movement? We're not. No. We need to look for the signs of the wind blowing.
Yeah. Well, and I think in terms of you can make quick work of what's going on in Ezekiel. And I just spent about 6 months teaching my way through Ezekiel to my faithful Wednesday night Bible study class. And we've had a good time and really helped me understand this is a big time turning point for not only Ezekiel and the people, but for the nation of Israel and in what God is doing in carrying out that covenant with Abraham that we saw blessing to all the people of the earth. But Israel is for all intents and purposes dead at this point. This is right after the final carrying away, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. I mean, it is as dark and desolate and depressing as it gets for the nation of Israel. They have no hope. And now God stands, and I like what you did with calls the wind. The wind blows from the four corners of the earth, says, I'm going to put breath in you. That's what fills up the lungs, and closes by saying, and it is my spirit in you that makes you live. And so this is a word of hope. God will not forget God's people, and God is in the resurrecting business. I will claim that here. In terms of God ultimately wants to make things new. And so it's a powerful way. Ezekiel's a vivid book. It's, you know, if you've never done a study all the way through it, I was pretty hesitant at first, but I enjoyed it as much as anything I've ever done, teaching my way through a Bible study in the book. And it really makes this closing section powerful.
And since it's a lot of resurrection today, if you haven't looked at Surprised by Hope by N.T. Wright, Rethinking Heaven, the Resurrection and the Mission of the Church, agree with him or not, it really opens up new ideas and ways of thinking about the resurrection, that we can get a little stayed in our thinking along those lines. And that opens up some wonderful opportunities to think about what that really is, what God is about, that may be a little bit more than we've thought about. Probably is. Psalm 130 ties both to Ezekiel and to the gospel lesson. That very first line, out of the depths I cry to you, those who are still surviving in Israel. You know, you can give that image of out of the depths where everything is in disaster around them, or you can think of a Lazarus inside the tomb, of that kind of coming forth, that tie of God being that hope that's there. Depths is the depths of the spirit. I think that's one of the interesting things. It could be along the lines of depression than any kind of physical kind of illness. And one of the things I love about this psalm is 3 and 4. This is my hobby horse about sin and forgiveness in the Hebrew scriptures. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, Lord, who could stand? But there is forgiveness with you so that you may be revered. It is he who will redeem Israel from all its iniquities. So.
Yep. Lord, if you're keeping score, we're screwed.
Yes. We're down.
We're in trouble.
Yeah, we're in trouble.
Yeah, that's a better translation there.
As Mark Twain said, if heaven were on merit rather than grace, your dog would go and you would stay out.
Thanks to Sam Clemens for that. Yeah. We better finish up then with another fine passage from Romans chapter 8.
Well, it's obviously tied to the gospel food through verse 11. He who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies also. There's really an interesting playoff in this text between flesh and spirit. And sometimes this has been kind of done in more Greek philosophy kind of ways, so that you have this splitting apart of the body, in which the soul is trapped. And that's not what Paul's talking about here. You can go very deeply into it, and we don't have the time, but the flesh has more to do with our earthly desires ignoring God. And if we only focus on eating, drinking, enjoyment, material pleasures, or material work, whatever, that's just focuses there, that leads ultimately, that's just a deadly existence. But in this same body, being aware of the spiritual realities, being alive to God and love and all those and peace, as he says, life and peace and all that, is that which brings life and brings you in connection with God, is where Paul is going, I think, with this passage.
Yeah, I agree. Not to divide this asunder, not to do as some, and it's certainly their right to do. I'm a good Baptist, y'all, and the soul competency and some of the other things we talk about. Okay, read it for yourself, but I do think it's important to see what the community has said through time and to understand Paul's larger argument here. It is not that we must completely mortify the works of the flesh. There can be nothing good in our bodies. Well, Paul says the body's the temple of the Holy Spirit, so there must be something good in our bodies. And we can't live completely in the realm of the Spirit. We live in this world, James is going to come back later the writer of Hebrews is going to come back later and is going to talk about this great high priest Christ who was tempted in every way like us. This is, this is how we live. What the key is for me is there in verse 10, and it's a favorite phrase of Paul's, Christ is in you. And there's the what matters. And so, yes, there's going to be some tension between the body and the flesh and the spirit and the things of God, but it is Christ in you, the hope of your glory.
Right.
And the spirit who raises Jesus from the dead that's also dwelling in you. It's a good passage. It'll preach. I may have to jump in on some Romans on this fifth Sunday of Lent. I'm still kind of thinking about it, but it'll preach.
But I have a guest preacher, so Whatever I put on the lab is the preaching I'm doing that Sunday.
Yeah, good deal. Good deal. Well, na-na-na-boo-boo, I'm off this next Sunday. So I'm off the fourth Sunday, and I'll be back the fifth Sunday. And
all right.
So anyhow, it's all good. Well, Bubba, thanks for your thoughts and getting us through here. Our best wishes and prayers for all who will be preaching this week and in the weeks to come. I don't guess there's much left for us to do, Bubba, but to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
As coroner, I'm a cover. I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only nearly dead, she's really most sincerely dead. And this is a day of independence for all the munchkins and their descendants. If any, yes, let the joyous news be spread. The wicked old witch at last is dead.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Mama Told Me by Frank Anea. We go out this session with When You Pass Through the Waters, also known as Do Not Fear, written and performed by Hillsong Church.
Through the waters, I will be with you, and the waves will not overcome you. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. For I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord your God. The
Lord.